Welcome to the French Horn Experiment. I'm Nathan Lutz, and in this podcast, I'll be exploring with you all things French horn, from solo repertoire to orchestral excerpts, from modern experiments to old favorites. Before I begin today's episode, I feel morally obliged to all of my fellow French horn players to issue an allergen warning. This episode may contain coprash. Honestly, you could probably put a warning on any recording of a French horn saying it was produced by someone who has also played Coprash. The etude I just played is from the second volume of 30 studies by Georg Coprash, written in the mid-1800s. To this day, the book remains one of the most common books of advanced studies up through high school, and as a result, some people remember it rather less fondly than others. What makes it so ubiquitous is the delicate balance that it strikes between musicality and functionality. If you were to make a number line on which 0 is a mind-numbingly specific exercise and 100 is a performable concert piece, Coprash etudes might score between a 20 and a 40. The exercise I just played is on the lower end of that, but believe me, there are much more mind-numbing exercises out there. For comparison, the Farkas etude book, The Art of the French Horn, abandons any attempt to be musical and instead strives to illustrate good practices and critical techniques. Check out this thrilling taste of what it's like to play a Farkas etude. I make fun of what little effort Farkas makes to be so attractive, but the fact is that these etudes are just as valuable as Coprash. Whether you use them as a warm-up routine or as a surgical tool to address a very particular part of your playing, etudes like this can be a much more efficient way to build muscle memory and healthy technique than the messy world of melodic etudes. It brings up a good question, though. If an etude works too hard to be musical, can that take away from its usefulness? Let's take a look at a piece from the opposite side of this scale. This is a Galay etude, the first of his 12 preludes. These are in a category called concert etudes, and on some instruments, equivalents like Chopin, for example, on piano, are frequently performed in concert.
Thank you.
So, yeah, this exercise doesn't exactly challenge a particular set of techniques, but here's the thing about etudes. If you ever find yourself practicing and are not thinking about tone quality and expressivity, you might be doing more harm than good to your playing. Even Farkas etudes need to be approached with different levels of volume and tone quality, because even if you can play those arpeggios perfectly well at a comfortable middle dynamic, you might be limiting yourself when it comes to actually using those skills in context. Concert etudes are about synthesis. If you can play them with a good tone that sounds confident and expressive, it means the skills that they require are more likely to translate to your actual performance. Galay exercises, in my opinion, are still mired at around a 70, but hey, maybe that means that only 30% of your audience will be checking their phones by the time you're 5 minutes in. When I'm practicing and want a really engaging exercise, there are a few other books that I pull from. One of my favorites is the Vern Reynolds 48 Studies. Not all of them are exactly concert-worthy, but they're written in a way which means they're never boring. Each one addresses a very specific part of your playing and then explores it through the lens of a rather avant-garde compositional technique to take it to the nth degree. The first bunch of them are all interval studies, and while I'm not entirely convinced that they're actually all that great for your playing, the fact is that they sound unlike just about anything else. Here's a study that I like to call the Whole Tone Waltz. I really love Reynolds etudes, but I will make a disclaimer here. I discovered these etudes in high school, but I really wasn't ready to play them. I liked them so much that I often went to extremes in order to reach some of the passages, and began to develop some unhealthy habits as a result. All the brass players out there can probably guess what this is, but when I wasn't stable enough in my high register to reach the really demanding notes that are in these exercises, I often took the usual shortcut and just used more pressure, which slowly saps playing flexibility and can lead to long-term damage. It may also have contributed to some breathing mechanics problems, which I'm still trying to work past, so here is a message to past me. All in moderation. It's tempting to play the more fun etude books because they're more musical, but they're also much more enjoyable when they're actually in your capability. Now, here's a question. If the reason that you're playing a concert etude is to test your technique in the context of a piece of concert music, why not just play the concertos? And yeah, you could make that argument. There are enough concertos out there to assemble a collection of actual concert music which tests pretty much every aspect of horn playing. Looking for low playing? Check out Hermann Neuling's Bagatelle for low horn. Stopped horn? Ducat Villanelle is perfect. Arpeggios? The two Richard Strauss concertos are like intermediate and advanced books for arpeggios. But here's the thing. None of the concertos that I just mentioned sound anything like an etude. I mean, that's not surprising, right? It can't be that hard for big-name composers to write advanced music which is also musically stimulating. Right? Well, step right up, Camille Saint-Saëns. This is the first movement from the Morceau de Concert, and, well, I'll let you be the judge. In fairness, the second and third movements of this concerto are actually pretty nice, but this whole theme and variations thing is such a classic part of many etude books that it seems very out of place to me. Also, there should be a piano part to go with this, but generally speaking, most concerto parts are fairly entertaining on their own. All that said, the fact that this could be mistaken for a skippable Volume 1 Koprasch etude was pretty disheartening when this was assigned as the competition piece for one of my PMEA district auditions in high school. In fact, I'm actually feeling like another Koprasch is in order. You've already heard the octaves etude. Let's go forward a couple of pages and play the trill synthesis study.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pretty unsubtle approach to studying trills. But notice how many different sections there were. This may not be a piece I would really want to perform in a concert, but it's amazing how close it gets to that level considering what an intensive and focused workout this piece is to play. Up to this point, everything that you've heard is an etude that I first worked on a long time ago and have periodically revisited it since, either because I like them as musical studies or because they challenge aspects of my playing that I was working on at the time. But part of the point of doing this podcast is to drive myself to uncover more music, so I thought I would take this opportunity to take a look at a set of etude books that I've been aware of for a while but never actually studied. These are the Maxime Alphand's 200 Studies, which could probably challenge Koprosh for how widely they're used. I would say that books 1 through 4 cover more or less the same material as Koprosh, but books 5 and 6 really start to separate themselves, sometimes because they are addressing more challenging techniques, and often, as I've found since picking these up, because they simply are really beautiful pieces. Technically, the Reynolds Etudes are more recent, but they're so avant-garde that they wouldn't work for a more general audience. The Maxime Alphand's books, on the other hand, are written in a style which reminds me of Debussy and Ravel, two of my favorite composers. I hope you enjoy the 8th Etude from Book 5. Thank you. This is the kind of thing that makes me very happy I'm doing this podcast. Besides being pleasant to play and listen to, the Alphonse books are exhaustively annotated with directions for how to play each exercise, calling out aspects which might be easy to ignore, but which makes them even better studies. So, as we've established, it is perfectly possible to find very entertaining music with which to study almost any skill on the French horn, whether by finding an appropriate etude or by playing particular passages from a concerto. But what about those etudes which come close to being performable, but just can't quite make it? Are they in a no-man's land where they aren't focused enough to be worth practicing or musical enough to be worth performing? Put in another way, what do you hear in your mind when you practice an etude? When playing a concerto or an excerpt, it's always useful to picture the sound of the instruments with whom you share the music. That way, when you go to play with them, you'll be more prepared on how to work with them expressively than if you just treated the passage as a series of notes. The problem is that this doesn't really work for an etude. Without any other parts, what is it that you're using to guide your performance? If all you're doing is following a metronome or staring at a tuner, then I'm not sure you're really getting the full benefit of your practice time. That isn't to say that those things aren't critical as a part of your practice routine, but they certainly aren't everything. Even basic etudes set up chord structures through arpeggiation, and even if the harmony is basic, picturing and adjusting your pitch to fit into the particular chord that you're outlining is actually more valuable in the context of a piece than arbitrarily following even temperament. You could also take it one step further and picture what the etude might sound like with an accompaniment. Remember that Saint-Saëns piece from earlier? The horn part is basically just a bunch of arpeggios, but add the piano part and it becomes a fair amount more interesting. What if we did something similar for a more deserving piece? This is a Koprasch exercise that is really verging on being a concert etude. It has a clear A-B structure, a key change, and plenty of articulations and dynamics marked. Most of all, I've always liked this one because it hints at a rapidly changing harmonic structure. That said, it probably isn't meant to have quite this degree of harmonic complexity. I hope you enjoy my arrangement of Georg Koprasch's Etude No. 45 for four horns. Probably not what Koprasch intended, but this is the benefit of doing this with an etude. I do get to make up whatever I want. Working on these etudes until they're almost performance ready has been a very interesting experience for me, and has actually made me reassess some of my practice strategies. So, in the spot after each episode, I'll start folding in occasional concert etudes. Stick around after the outro for a recording of Reynolds' Etude No. 6. And if you really want to hear some Reynolds etudes played terrifyingly well, there's a YouTube channel titled just The Etude, with some staggering performances at full tempo, so yeah, still plenty for me to work on. This has been the fourth episode of the French Horn Experiment. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please leave a like and comment if there's anything you'd like to hear me explore.